Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brenda Bartles. My registration number is 17117. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I represent the intervener in this case, Svetlana Shields. In reviewing documents and law and rules and procedures in this matter, and again in preparation for this argument, a key section, granted not case law or a rule or statute, but a method of practice that's that cites Rule 102 and Sections 1355-102, which is what should have been followed in this case. The person writing the article says, the attorney should exercise great care to avoid attachment of property not belonging to defendant because the plaintiff and could possibly be liable for damages resulting from the wrongful taking.
Also, is this article cited in your briefs?
It was not.
Provide it to the other side today?
I did not. I was just suggesting this was an analysis of Rule 102.
I understand, but you know, have you read our orders about providing supplemental authorities?
And I suggested it's not an authority. It's a commentary on the rules and the statute as a lead-in to what was appropriate in this case, what should have been done in this case under Rule 102, which is cited in my brief and was cited at the trial court, as well as the misuse.
No. All I was going to say is that it would appear to me that when you're relying on someone else's opinion to bolster or buttress your argument, it is a type of authority,
okay,
which should have been brought to the attention of us earlier, as well as given a chance to the other side to respond to as well.
Okay. Thank you. So, from my perspective, as argued in the trial court, as argued in our briefs, there were inappropriate melding of the various rules in this case to seize the property of a person that was not a judgment debtor in this case. There was
Bartles, where did the trial court rule on this specific issue below?
Where?
I looked at the transcript of the hearing. It does not appear that this particular issue of the, as you put it, the mulching of various procedures was raised at the hearing. There was no ruling by the trial court on that issue. There was no post-trial motion in the trial court on that issue.
Okay.
Why is it even reviewable in this court?
Okay. It was discussed with the sheriff's department or the sheriff's department person as far as the rules that were used. It was also an issue as far as the with the record on appeal. It was not raised during the trial court, except to the extent that it was argued again and again and again that the property of that's not of the judgment debtor cannot be seized under any procedure. So
I understand that was kind of the crux of the whole matter, was whose property is this, but it doesn't seem to follow to me that under that we can include every conceivable argument that could have been made, and that this particular argument was not raised at the hearing.
It was not a specific issue at the hearing, except for when the documents were addressed with the sheriff's department. You're absolutely correct, and so I'll move on. Again, personal property, which is not the property of the judgment debtor, is not subject to execution to satisfy the judgment of Mr. Aranda. This is the law. There was no finding regarding that piece. It kept getting jumped over by the trial court, by plaintiffs during the hearing, and that continued in the trial briefs. There was never a finding that Mr. Aranda owned this vehicle, only that he drove it from time to time, and yes, possessed maybe this vehicle before Ms. Shields purchased it, and definitely afterward.
Is there a finding that Shields did not own this vehicle?
There wasn't that either, Your Honor. The only finding from the court was that there was evidence sufficient to cause the trial court to question the validity of the alleged sale of the vehicle to Ms. Shields. Well, yes, there were issues brought up regarding the odometer issue, regarding some of the signatures. They did forensics on the documents that were provided to the plaintiffs after the fact when we requested that Ms. Shields' property be returned to her. And there were forensics, and there was lots of what I have termed red herrings issued. But the fact was that she went to a dealer, she paid reasonable value, fair market value for this vehicle, she received documents, and maybe there was a question regarding somebody's signature not looking like somebody else's signature, but she had possession of the vehicle. But there was no finding, and granted, there might have been some problems with that, but some problems suggested with those issues regarding the odometer and maybe a signature that didn't look quite right. But just because the trial court questioned the validity, he still had to go to the next step and say that Mr. Aranda, the judgment debtor, owned that property. That never happened.
Sorry, Judge.
Okay. What is the significance of the court's finding that Mr. Aranda was trying to avoid registering the vehicle? Would not an owner be the only person who could register the vehicle?
Yes, but there was no such finding that he was the owner and therefore avoiding trying to register the vehicle. The trial court just totally ignored the consideration that was paid and had some problems with some of the documents. But there needed to be a finding that he owned the vehicle. The trial court fell into the trap that he possessed the vehicle and therefore there must be some kind of ownership. And the court never got that far because it couldn't. Plaintiffs did not call Mr. Aranda to testify regarding any ownership of this vehicle. To the contrary, the testimony from the intervener was that she bought and paid for this vehicle and that Mr. Aranda had absolutely no participation in this. She proved that she owned a vehicle free and clear and that she had cash money from a life insurance policy. But the trial court fell into the same trap and needed to find that under the Brink versus McNeil that that the judgment debtor had to own that property, and that no one ever got that far. Neither did the court make any findings regarding constructive trust, and that's because the proof wasn't there. There was no evidence that the money loaned by the plaintiffs to Mr. Aranda was to purchase this vehicle, and something happened where there wasn't a collateralization or something like that. There was no proof of that, no evidence of that. Similarly, there was no evidence and no finding of fraudulent conveyance, yet plaintiff continues to use those arguments. And for good reason, there was no finding regarding fraudulent conveyance because the statute cited and relied on by the plaintiff, it doesn't fit this situation. The vendor that they're saying in that situation was Colorado Sport and RV. Well, the vendor at issue in that, as it relates to that statute, would have to have been the person trying to defraud Colorado Sport and RV's creditors. There was no evidence that Mr. Aranda transferred this vehicle to Ms. Shields. There's insinuations as to that, but that again ignores the arm's length transaction, the proof of payment by Ms. Shields to Colorado Sport and RV when she acquired this vehicle.
Part of the proof was a title document that the supposed signatory on testified he couldn't have signed. Isn't that correct?
He stated that he did not work for Colorado Sport and RV at the time, but he said, that's my signature. So maybe a mistake was made and he pre-signed it. I don't know.
Couldn't an inference be made that somebody else signed it for him?
Yes.
And couldn't an inference be made that that was Mr. Aranda? Or somebody working at his behest?
There was no inference of that, and also the person who was testifying to that questionable signature and timing said that Mr. Greger, whose signature he did identify, was the owner of Colorado Sport and RV. Ms. Shields testified that that's the person she transacted the business with, and his signature was throughout the various documents. Then she signed it, she got insurance on the vehicle, and had not titled the car yet, but she'd only owned it for 2 weeks, had only paid her consideration and owned it for 2 weeks when the plaintiff came in and seized the property.
Wasn't there evidence that the car had been sold to Colorado RV in 2004? How then did this car, or at least evidence suggesting this car was being driven around by Mr. Aranda before he had obtained title to it or before Ms. Shields had obtained title to it? What explanation is there in the record for that?
There was testimony from the plaintiffs that that Mr. Aranda was seen driving this vehicle or a vehicle like it or some Hummer, granted. That was long before Ms. Shields even met Mr. Aranda, and granted, he was given permission after she purchased it in September of 2009 to use it at, when they were living together. I think there is evidence, and we don't suggest to the other to the contrary, that this vehicle, he may have been driving it before he met her. But there's no evidence that he ever took title to it, paid a dime for it, anything. He was driving it permissive use from Colorado Sport and RV. There's no switching of title after the Smiths traded it in to the time Ms. Shields purchased this vehicle. I don't know if he was test driving it. I don't know. There was no evidence to that effect. We were there to prove that Ms. Shields bought and paid for this vehicle, and there was no evidence. There was some hearsay suggestions, but there was no evidence that Mr. Aranda paid any consideration for this, but merely drove it. But possession does not equal ownership.
Was there any dispute in the record that this was the same 2004 Hummer that was initially described with the unsuccessful seizure?
There was some suggestions regarding that it was the same, but there was no identification of VIN numbers. And there was a suggestion he was driving a silver Hummer when he was seen in 2008 before he met Ms. Shields. This was a champagne gold-colored Hummer. Don't know. There was lots of insinuation and innuendo during the testimony, and he was seen driving a Hummer, but he was not called to say that it's the same Hummer. There was no VIN comparison in the record that I know of. Any other questions? I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thanks.
Good afternoon. David Cook, number 17763. I think part of the confusion here, I know I was confused with the reply brief and also the way that the issue was framed by the intervener. And that's because at the very beginning of the hearing, she took on the burden of proof. She conceded that she had the burden of proof. And you just heard it again. I was there to prove that my client had title to the Hummer. We don't need to get to the other issues, having failed to meet that burden that she took on and became the law of the case. And for good reason. She's the intervener. She's coming in, she's coming before the court, and she's saying, that's my Hummer, that's not Aranda's Hummer. So she had that burden, and that's the initial burden. And she took it on, rightly so. Having failed to meet that burden, this other issue about whether or not we proved Aranda was the owner or not is irrelevant. The case was over. She didn't meet her burden of proof. That's a red herring right there, is, you know, trying to insist that after she failed to meet her burden, that we had some additional burden. It was in the transcript at 13, at page 13, where counsel admitted that she had the burden of proof. If we had known that the argument was going to be, and maybe the subject of the appeal was, that Aranda was actually the owner of the vehicle, the case would have been framed differently, would have been presented differently.
I think the argument is that he was the owner.
It depends on which side you're looking at it from. Sorry to confuse the court on that. Our argument, nevertheless, was that Aranda was the owner of the vehicle. I actually think that when we established his possession of the vehicle and the fact that it had a temporary tag on it, Mr. Jones, the car salesman, testified the difference between a temporary tag, which indicates a change of ownership, and there's two statutes on that are in the brief, and a dealer tag, which is the dealer still owns it and he's driving it around, but the dealer still owns it. So if someone has proved repeatedly that there was possession of the vehicle in Aranda, and every time it had a temporary tag on it, when the intervener had the burden to come forward, then the court looked at that, I think, as a threshold issue also. You can kind of see the way that the court's order is structured. He starts out by finding that the Shields documents were fraudulent. Specious is the word that the court used. Fraudulent is the same thing. The bottom line is that he didn't give any credence or effect to that bundle of title documents for good reason, and he had no obligation to do so. As was noted in a couple of questions, that if she had the burden of going forward and proving that, there's lots of unanswered questions. How was it that Mr. Aranda was driving around this vehicle for over a year, according to the court's findings, with temporary tags on it? This is a year before the alleged sale. It's actually a finding. The specious mileage differential. That's on the title. That's a box that's signed under penalty of perjury. That's the mileage on that vehicle. Very important deal. 6,400, whatever it is, miles that can't be accounted for. It's on the face of the document. Then we have the issue of the signatures. One issue, yes, there is no explanation for how that signature, how he could have signed it. My theory of the case isn't that Mr. Aranda actually forged the dealer's signature, Mr. Jones' signature on that. It's that when Mr. Aranda purchased the vehicle, I know this happened when I bought mine, my name actually was not inserted in the title. The dealer signed off on it, and I got a blank title to put whatever name in there later on I wanted to put in there when I registered it. So even though I purchased it, I was free to write in somebody else's name. And I think that's exactly what happened here. Mr. Aranda bought
it. What about the date on that document? The date on that document is not the earlier date back in 2008. It's 2009, I believe.
That's correct.
So doesn't that kind of counter your theory? Kind of undercut your theory? Because presumably the date's put on there by the dealer, not later by the whoever purchases the vehicle.
Well, then that's impossible because the court believed Mr. Jones' testimony that he hadn't worked there for over a year, so he couldn't assign it. But that was his signature. His testimony was that it was his signature. So that's just an impossibility. The date had to have been left blank also on that. What we're really talking about is, were the findings sufficient? And we have Rule 52 that has the clearly erroneous standard. It was up to the court to judge the credibility of the witnesses. The court did so, did not find Ms. Shields' testimony or documents to be credible. They were specious. The opinion has to be sufficient in the findings of fact and conclusions it is sufficient if the findings of fact and conclusions of law appear therein. It has to be so clearly erroneous as to find no support in the record. Clearly, that's not the case here. And then the last one was the last case that was cited in the reply brief, this Rocky Mountain Healthcare Maintenance Organization case. And that case says there is sufficient compliance with the rule if the ultimate facts have been determined and the conclusions of law are entered. Well, the judge determined, as between the two parties that were there to argue over the right to possess the Hummer, that the Hummer was properly with my client. He determined the ultimate issue that was there between the parties that were there. That's why I think this whole issue of whether Aranda had title and if we met our burden of proving that Aranda had title is confusing to me. Aranda wasn't there. There was burden on behalf of Shields to prove her case. She failed to meet the burden. Why are we here talking about if I prove something that relates to Aranda? Here are the findings of fact from the court's order. First, the dealer's agent had not worked at the dealership for a year prior to the date of sale listed on the title. Two, Aranda was driving the Hummer both before and after the date of the alleged sale by the dealer to Ms. Shields. Three, in order to escape the consequences of seizure of the Hummer, based upon debts owed and judgments pending, Aranda drove the Hummer unregistered for more than a year. Four, the mileage listed in the alleged title transfer is specious. No evidence to support the likelihood that 6,000 or 7,000 miles were put on the Hummer in the 2 weeks between the alleged purchase and the seizure. Specific findings of fact. Definitely not devoid of any findings of fact. Conclusions of law. Ms. Shield cannot support her claim that she legitimately purchased the Hummer. That is a finding of law. She's not the owner. The Hummer was Aranda's. As the judge pointed out, he can't have failed to register it for more than a year if he was not the owner. The judge assumed when he said that statement that that was the case. Next, in order to avoid paying his debts, Aranda did not register the Hummer. My point exactly. He didn't want my client and others that were chasing after him to seize the Hummer from him, so he just didn't register it. I think the essence of intervener's argument is that we weren't able to establish a chain of title. Therefore, it was improper for us to seize it. Well, we weren't able to establish a chain of title because of the actions of Mr. Aranda in trying to avoid the payment of his just debts. He controlled the situation. He manipulated the situation. The court found so in order to defraud my client. Therefore, that can't be part of what we have to prove. The judge found that that was impossible because of the actions of Aranda. And that this whole specious title is, in fact, an attempt to defraud my client. When you read the order as a whole, the findings of fact of what happened, that's the only conclusion that you can reach, and it doesn't leave any guessing to be involved. That's what happened here. The other issues regarding the fraudulent conveyance and the other things I raised at the time were as a backup in case the court found that it had actually been transferred. They're not necessary for the determination. The court disposed of this by finding that Ms. Shields did not prove her case that she owned the Hummer. If she doesn't own the Hummer, we don't need to get to those other arguments that I made. The issue between the parties was resolved. I actually think that the fact of when we prove the fact of possession, we established a prima facie case. And are entitled to the presumption that the writer title was in Aranda. And the reason for that is from the UCC. It's CRS 42401. And that provides in its very outset. It discusses that the article shall apply with regards to the rights, obligations, buyers, sellers, other third parties, and applies irrespective of title to the goods. And it says it applies to all matters when matters concerning title become material, it provides, unless otherwise explicitly agreed, title passes to the buyer at the time and place in which the seller completes his performance with reference to the physical delivery of the goods. When Aranda took physical delivery of the Hummer and drove it around unregistered, as the court found for all that time, he was presumptively the owner. I established a prima facie case. Other case law on that. Non-delivery of a certificate of title does not prevent the change of ownership as between the parties to the transaction. The fact and all the other law I said is also very clear about this. It's the law is very careful to make sure in many different instances there are different theories that people can't avoid the consequences of their debts and avoid their creditors by simply placing their property in somebody else's name. That's the law. No matter how you slice it, which theory you use, that's the law. And that's all this was. This was an attempt to place the property in somebody else's name to avoid the consequences of a seizure. Thank you.
The point that's being missed here is, what was the status of this Hummer on October 1, 2009, the date of the seizure?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
How do you respond to the argument that what the court was to determine by virtue of your client's complaint was simply whether she owned the vehicle? If she establishes she owns the vehicle, she gets the vehicle back. If she doesn't establish that she owns the vehicle, she doesn't get the vehicle back. So why are we even discussing whether Mr. Aranda owned the vehicle?
I agree with you, Your Honor. And the court allowed all this irrelevant testimony as to what happened before September 18th, 2009. The court also ignored that she paid $10,000 cash, that she turned over and traded in a vehicle worth $11,000 that was free and clear. What about that evidence? That just goes away? That doesn't matter? That she paid consideration for this vehicle? That was paid on September 18th, 2009. The temporary tags that were on the vehicle from that point until October 1, when it was seized, said Svetlana Shields. Those temporary tags said that then.
That's not exactly my question. My question is, was the court required to find that Mr. Aranda owned the vehicle, or was the court simply required to find whether your client owned it or not?
I think, as I've argued, that the court was required to find that he owned the vehicle, and therefore the plaintiffs were entitled to seize this property to address the debt owed.
But if it wasn't your client's property, then how does your client have any standing at all to complain about the seizure under any statute, rule, whatever?
And it continues to be our position. She owned the property. She bought that property. And had they seized the property before September 18th of 2009, when she bought it from the dealer with consideration, I see their argument. But there was an intervening transaction that everyone is ignoring. They made a lot of allegations and suggestions regarding signatures here and there, again, after the fact. But it ignores the situation that she walked into that dealership, whether Mr. Aranda had a relationship with that vehicle prior to that or not, whether he drove it around, whether the temporary tags were in whoever's name. There was no proof as to that. But there was no proof that he bought that and had... Another thing, had he transferred it to Ms. Shields, then we would be in a whole different situation.
You keep saying that she paid all this money and all that, but didn't the court implicitly reject your client's testimony? There was no proof other than your client's testimony. Mm-hmm. Had the court accepted your client's testimony as credible, the result would have been different. Mm-hmm. So doesn't that imply that the court found your client's testimony not credible?
I think it implies that the court listened to all these red herrings about Mr. Aranda driving around in this untitled vehicle, and who knows why or whose permission it was under. Possibly he was driving it around under the permission or under a test drive of Colorado Sport and RV. That's not the issue between Ms. Shields and the plaintiffs. That's an issue between the state of Colorado and whether Colorado Sport and RV was doing something inappropriate or Mr. Aranda and Colorado Sport and RV were doing something inappropriate. The intervening transaction, the court got looped into that.
But the law is that that there can't be the repossession or the seizure of property not owned by the judgment debtor, and that's exactly what happened here.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, again for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course.